Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, producer of the show, and we're really happy to have you here today. We have a fantastic guest. He is someone I met some months ago, and we've been trying to get him on the show, and he is finally here talking about Police Chief Mike Alexander. He is a principal partner of the Lion Strategy Group. He is a leadership and life coach and trainer, and he also sits on the board of the Narrative Enneagram. He is a fascinating individual, just a beautiful human being, and I know you are going to love this show. So without any further ado, let's get to the host of our show, Ian Cron.
Mike Alexander, welcome to Typology.
Glad to be here.
You are an Enneagram 6.
I am.
And we love Enneagram 6s.
Some of our favorites.
It is one of our favorites. We love us some Enneagram 6s.
I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, we're going to find out. So you have one of the most amazing resumes that I've read of one of our guests on the show. And what I'd love for you to do is just in brief, if you would, tell us a little bit about how you came to discover the Enneagram and how you're using it in your life.
Okay. That's a very good question. I think it's around 2001, 2002, I believe. I retired from the Austin Police Department. We had an onslaught of alcohol related issues happening within the police department, where one of the events were pretty egregious. We lost a high ranking official, a commander, and her husband. They were doing what we call a poker run, a very good, worthy fundraiser for a worthy group organization. I don't recall the organization, but they were going from bar to bar and getting either a card or a poker chip, and then they would go to the next one. And while they were doing what they were doing, they were also consuming alcohol. And so quite a few of them got fairly intoxicated, and the commander and her husband lost their lives that day. And so quite a few of them were intoxicated, and the chief of police tried to intervene by inquiring, well, what happened and why didn't anyone say anything to her? And of course, they were afraid to do so. And I'll talk about that later on, about four things that we typically see in organizations that are void of certain things, but they were afraid. And so he decided to do an investigation. And once he did that, the police association came after him. So he backed out of it a little bit. Mm. And then I got a phone call from him, and he asked me if I had any answers to why these things were occurring. Now, the reason he asked me is because I was at the time highly engaged with work with Department of Justice across the country, dealing with ethics and integrity issues within police departments that were struggling with those issues. And so he asked me if I could help him. And I told him at the time, I said, Chief, I really don't have a solid answer for you right now, but if you give me an opportunity, I will give you some answers. So it was at that point I reached out to a police psychologist of mine by the name of Dr. Rick Bradstreet. And he was a 25-year veteran of the police department as a psychologist. He had retired by that time. So I reached out, he and I met at a Starbucks, and we sat there for 5 hours. Hmm. And we talked about the underbelly of policing. And from that was the evolution of a curriculum we called Hidden Hazards. And Hidden Hazards were designed to teach supervisors how to pick up on micro issues to mitigate the macro. And during that time, Rick Bradstreet introduced the Enneagram to that curriculum, but he did not call it the Enneagram. He didn't call it anything. He just introduced the process. And I was highly intrigued by it. And so I began to ask questions. Hmm. And he told me at the time that he thought I was a 2. And the reason he thought I was a two, I understand now, because I was so willing to help deal with the issues that were happening within the police department. But unbeknownst to him, and perhaps even me, that my real motivation was fear. I was concerned with the things that were happening. And these guys work with me and they make calls with me. And I really don't know what I don't know. So I wanted to make sure that everyone was safe. So he asked me a question one day. I can't recall what the question were, but I said something that intrigued him. And at that point, he invited me to a workshop. And he had me take an assessment. And once I took the assessment, it came out as a six. He then invited me and put me on a panel with other sixes. And that was that's when I went, I took a deep dive at that point. And to be quite frank, I actually discovered Mike Alexander that day as well, because I didn't know me either.
Wow. Yeah.
Tell me more about that. What do you mean you discovered Mike Alexander?
Well, there were things about me and why I did the things that I did, why certain things were conflictual for me, why I sometimes, from the perspective of others, when I saw things, I spoke about those things, and sometimes they thought I was being negative, when in actuality, I saw danger, and I tried to be proactive and speak to the issue before it happened. And so sometimes how I spoke about it came across to the receiver as negative. And so I just couldn't understand, because most of the times when I saw what I saw, it actually came to fruition. And then sometimes I would then say, I told you so. And so very sarcastically. And so it wasn't until I recognized that, then I could temper myself. I can regulate myself. I can speak different. I can change my cadence. I can change my approach. And once I began to do that, then I was included a lot more. They were asking more questions instead of pushing me away.
Right. So you're beautifully describing what happens when self-awareness becomes becomes operational, right? When it's working and you're able to step back from yourself, observe what's going on in the moment, and regulate the way that you're acting, thinking, and feeling, that you might better connect to yourself and to the world around you.
Yeah, exactly. Very well said.
So you're a counterphobic six. Right. Can you describe or that's what your bio says. So you tell me.
No, I think I'm a social six. But I struggle with counterphobic. I am a counterphobic six, but I'm a social
subtype. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I am definitely a counterphobic. So I sometimes come across looking like an eight.
Yes. Right.
And so that energy is coming from me, especially when. I know what I know, and people are resisting what I know. I don't even know how to describe it. But that energy is emanating from me, and I'm trying to contain it at the same time. But frustration is also coming up, and I become almost a beast sometimes.
And is that because, and here's what most people say about, counterphobic sixes. And by the way, I'm of the mind that actually there's a continuum between phobic and counterphobic, and that all sixes actually, you could say I live more at this end of the counterphobic spectrum most of the time, or down here toward the phobic end. But I think all sixes live on a spectrum between the two. And sometimes, because they're ambivalent typically, right? So, sometimes they become aggressive and attack the source of danger and other, not knowing they're afraid. They're just like going on the attack against what they perceive is the source of, you know, they're whatever, the threat. And then other times they're more submissive than they are rebellious,
exactly.
You know, and so it can go like this, you know, in the course of a day, you know.
Right, right. Well, what I call that is when I'm teaching and I talk about the six, I always say that the healthy six vacillate between the phobic and counterphobic. They know when the six is healthy, they know what battles to fight and which battles to let go.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, we stay on that continuum back and forth, back and forth. So when we come face to face with an issue or a challenge, we make a decision. Is this a battle worth fighting, or is this one of those situations mm-hmm. where we need to let it go? If I'm counterphobic all the time, then I fight every battle. If right. I'm phobic all the time, I run from every situation. So mm-hmm. you're absolutely right. We vacillate between that continuum.
Right. Thank you. And so do you ever stop and ask yourself when you're starting to feel emotions that are uncomfortable, do you ever stop and ask yourself the question, what am I afraid of right now? Like, what's the fear here that's driving any number of other emotions that maybe I'm tempted to act out on?
Oh, I absolutely do now. And I tell you what, that has saved me in so many ways. Mm. As a police chief, as a city manager, you know, you're coming across people who are very confrontational all the time. And sometimes I'm the trigger by decisions that I make.
Mm-hmm.
So when I begin feel that way, I actually breathe into that energy in my body so I can settle myself before I speak. Because if I stay in that kind of phobic, I'm going to match their energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, because what I'm looking for is a win-win. And, you know, your question actually reminds me of Stephen M. R. Covey's book, The Speed of Trust.
Mm-hmm.
Where he talks about straight talk versus double talk. And what that does for me, it caused me to kind of regulate, bring my energy down, and breathe in, and then I speak.
Yes.
Because what I'm trying to do is, in a crucial conversation like that, I'm trying to create a win-win.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's good. Anthony, this is like, you know, well, I just have to say one thing about this, right?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, what we're seeing in real time is someone who's done some work, right?
Definitely.
Because you've already introduced the whole somatic piece, right? Like in the
yes.
body, reconnecting, breathing, trying to find the space between reacting and responding.
Yes.
Right? So that you're not in reactivity, but you're kind of stepping back and collecting the self and so that you can respond from a good space. Now, the other person may remain in reactivity, but you're not, right? You're,
right. Exactly.
You've sort of detached from the situation and you're able to step into it. And that's really good work for a six, but for every type, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Like, for example, do you know where in your body is the sort of the red flag? Fear is here. Anxiety is here. Where is that for you?
For me, it hits me sort of in my rib cage.
Mm-hmm.
And when it does, I immediately feel it. And, you know, I always equate this when I'm explaining it to others, because I tell everyone, anytime your nervous system is about to be hijacked, there will always be an energy in your body somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
We have to learn our bodies, just like a mechanic know an engine. They
yes.
know it very, very well, to where they can hear a little tick. It may
yes.
be a very obscure tick, and they can stop that car and go and diagnose it right away. The
right.
body is a machine as well. So I tell them, what we need to start doing is slow down and pay attention to the energy in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And once it happens, you should be able to go to that energy and sit with it.
Mm.
And then you move it to where you want it to move by breathing into it before you speak. And when you do that, that conversation, that situation, actually most of the time will turn out the way you want it to turn out.
Oh,
that's fantastic, isn't it?
It is really great.
I love this.
It really is great.
It makes me think of, so my son is a six, and he's 19, and he keeps getting in the loop of trying to get rid of the fear. And I'm like, no, you just need to identify it, because it will serve you well if you can identify it and meet it where, like you're saying now.
I was right there with him. I was there when I discovered I was a six. I did everything I possibly could to get rid of being a six. Mm-hmm. I said, this is not right. This is not me. But now I love the idea of being a six.
Oh, that's good. What do you love about being a six?
I love the idea of worst case scenario first.
That's awesome.
I rarely hear a six say that. Well, tell me why that's a superpower.
Well, because it prepares me. Now, I probably lose a lot of sleep. I probably worry about things that may never come to fruition. But man, am I prepared when that thing, and if it does come to fruition, I am solid.
Yeah.
I am grounded. I am calm. But that is why I love it. I'm very good at picking up on micro issues, and I have a great bullshit detector.
Yeah. No, that's
so good.
So, but, yeah. And by the way, sixes do have a great bullshit detector.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, you know, I when I work with sixes, like when I lead workshops or things like that, you know, I always laugh. I say the sixes always have their arms folded and their legs crossed in the first 30 minutes. You know, they're just like this, and because I'm the authority figure,
right?
And the authority figure, they're kind of ambivalent about. They're like looking at me and they're like, okay, is this guy gonna try and pull the wool over my eyes? Is he gonna be, you know, is he straight up? Is he a double talker or a straight talker? You know, then once you've established that you're trustworthy, right? You just start to see their body relax, you know, and they just kind of melt a little bit. And within about 2 hours, they're taking notes and laughing and having a good time. But at the beginning, you can see the suspicion in their body.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Well, that's the very reason I use my road trip of 8 hours to listen to podcasts, so I can prepare myself for your cadence, and so I can relax, and that my anxiety would not be off the charts. Because I always know, number one, I don't really like doing these kinds of things. But because if I can't control my nervous system, my anxiety, I'm all over the board. I am just spastic. Mm. And I hate when that happens to me.
Mm.
I love this because it encourages me. I can't wait for my son to listen to this podcast, to even watch you, because it's like you are a powerful presence and you're such a gift to our community, but you still are struggling with those fears, right? Oh, it's like absolutely. You're not eliminating that. So I just can't wait for Justice to see this. This is great.
Yeah. You know, Mike, I have I've had an interest for many years in Tibetan Buddhism. And one of the things that's been so helpful is learning to sit with what is, right? So you know, instead of saying I'm anxious, you know, we would say something like anxiety is here.
Yeah.
Or fear is here, or happiness is here. And you know what I mean? In other words, not to get over identified with it, but to see like, okay, this is an impermanent feeling. It is going to come in and it will go away.
That's right.
That's right. So I call that name it. When you name it, you can claim it.
Yeah.
Once I claim it, I own it. But if I can't name it, it owns me.
Mm-hmm.
So once I feel it, once it comes in, I name it. And when I name it, at that point, I claim it, and I now am in control versus it being in control.
All right. So we all know that anytime we see a stereotype on television, right, Anthony, that, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt, right? And, you know, so you watch police shows, right, or detective shows, and there is a stereotype of policemen, right?
Correct.
Mike is not that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like Mike is actually speaking in some very, what I would call, high level spiritual terms, right? Because there is a spirituality to the Enneagram. And I know that in my work and corporate world, I can't talk too deeply about spirituality without the CEO getting a little squirrely because, you know, that's not appropriate in a corporate setting. But I want to know, Mike, for you, what's the spiritual dimension of the Enneagram like? Like, what's that about for you? Now, psychology, that's one piece, but what's the spirituality side?
Well, if I'm understanding the question, you know, I'm absolutely God-fearing. And I see the parallel between the two. I see the parallel between God's word and the Enneagram. And, you know, the whole emotional intelligence piece, that's biblical. And it teaches me how, in spite of the person that I'm dealing with, to always treat them with dignity and respect. It helps me to have compassion for people when they are struggling. It helps me to recognize that I may be the trigger of something that happened to them 15 years ago.
Yes, awesome. That is awesome.
Wow.
My therapist said to me the other day, you know, I just happened to mention that I'd had an interaction with somebody that was unpleasant. And he goes, yeah, maybe you reminded him of his mother. you know, and I was like, oh, yeah, I guess that's possible.
Right.
You know, it wasn't personal. It was historical.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we just never know what is being triggered in other people. Yeah. All right, Mike. So I have a question for you. Police officers, what types do you tend to see more often than any other among police forces?
I see a lot of ones.
Yeah.
I see a lot of twos. Mm. I see a lot of threes. I see fives, not a lot of them, but I see fives. I see quite a few sixes. I see a ton of eights and nines.
Yeah.
What I don't see a lot of are fours and sevens. And, you know, I was in Little Rock. I was actually dealing with educators, but most settings that's the case, but especially in policing, I will occasionally have a five or a four. I seldom have fours. And I always say when that comes up, I say, I know I have them because I had a four working on a team that I led in my first chief job. Man, what a unique guy who I always, and he's a young man, and fours for me have old souls. And I just love talking to fours. I have a son that's a four, and he's a coach. And man, the guy is just awesome. I love talking with him. You know, there are times when I'm thinking I'm going to counsel him, and it's the opposite. He ended up counseling me, and I'm saying, wow. But so ones, twos, threes, an occasional five, but quite a few sixes, occasional seven. But eights and nines, but the four and the seven are the two that I seldom see a lot.
Yeah, and I can see that. You know, partly because police departments, and please correct me if I'm wrong, if I start to lapse into stereotypes, right? Sevens don't like bureaucracies.
Right.
They don't like repetition.
That's right.
They like spontaneity.
That's exactly right.
They don't like necessarily the predictability that might come, you know, along with that. Fours, I totally get it. You know, it's interesting, in the corporate world, I rarely meet fours, at least in the corporations I've worked with, right? If I meet them, they're somebody like they're the web designer or they're, you know, doing very creative, you know, marketing work or something like that. But they don't gravitate toward positions that, you know, we would, you know, probably suspect they wouldn't. You know, it's uncommon. I meet a lot of fours who work for themselves, artists, musicians, not folks in sort of creative spaces. They could be floral arrangers. They could be yoga teachers. They could be, you know, whatever. But they're usually doing something also very heart-ish, you know.
Right. And that's he's a coach, but he's a musician.
Right.
And an artist.
Is his coaching supporting the art?
Do what now?
Does it support the art? Is that why he's coaching? Because
Yes, exactly. Right.
That's pretty common, I think, among fours. They'll do another day job, but it's really to support the art.
Yeah, it's exactly right.
Right, the creative endeavor. Now, this guy that was working for you that was a four, I'm just curious about this, right? Was he just a regular police officer working on the street, you know, like, what was his?
Yes, he was a patrol sergeant.
And he was a sergeant, so he had done well.
Right.
In his career.
By that time, I introduced him to the Enneagram.
Right.
So when I entered, the first thing I do is all of my leadership, I give them, it's an online assessment, so I can get an idea of who they are. And when I discovered he was a four, I began to work with him. So he embraced it, but he was a patrolman. But I struggled with him because of his, there are moments when he was highly depressed. And then there are moments when he's on the mountaintop and trying to find that balance with him was a struggle for me.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, I'd love to know that guy's story. I'd love to know how a four ended up as a policeman, because it just is not what you think, right?
No, it just doesn't
seem like their world. Now, you're on the board of Helen Palmer School, right? The Enneagram and the Narrative Tradition. I have done a ton of studying. I don't know if you're aware of that with, I know Peter and everybody else that's on board, and you have a new CEO or president, right? Who I've met,
who's Brian.
Brian, right?
Brian.
And so this is, you've studied, man. Like, this thing, right? It's not like you're not a dabbler, right? You've really done some deep work.
Right.
When you're doing work in police or in other settings, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do people first respond to it?
Well, I don't go in introducing it as the Enneagram. If I'm dealing with police officers, I call it DNA. This is your DNA. And
that's good.
Because at that point, they can resonate with that word and they embrace it.
Yeah.
But once I open it and unpack it, they are all in.
Yeah. And then you can tell them it's the Enneagram.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly when I do. And at that point, they introduce it to their spouses.
Yes.
Because they become very curious about
it. So you're working in Minneapolis, right? You're doing some work. Tell us what you're doing.
I'm making an attempt to get into Minneapolis. I met with every police chief in the state of Minnesota to discuss some of the work I do around what we're talking about now and the Workforce Behavior Intervention Platform. Here's what I think happened. I'm speculating, but I think I scared the living daylights out of them, to be quite frank.
Wow.
Because it's a leadership tool, and it will definitely cause leaders to hold one another accountable. And right now we can easily say I was unaware, but that's absolutely not true either. When you look at the whole George Floyd, Derek Chauvin situation, and you look at the history of Derek Chauvin, they knew this guy had the propensity to do what he did.
Mm.
When it happened, they were all saying they were not surprised. So my system is designed to pick up on those micro issues before it get to the point where we have to say I'm not surprised. Mm. It caused leaders to be engaged right away when they pick up on negative energy in the bodies of their employees. And so I carefully designed the system to where when that leader is engaged with that employee, they can see what they see. And it's not subjective. It's based off of the seven empirical emotions that the Enneagram also speaks to. And when you look at levels of development, and particularly around level five of each of the nine levels, that is the stage there where the nervous system is under attack and oftentimes is about to be hijacked. And so at that point, that's still micro issue. And so I teach leaders, this is where you need to be laser focused. And when you see something, you need to inquire, but you need to do a whole lot of work before that time, because it's still somewhat your perception. But I need you to even inquire about your perception, but you can't do it until you do your work in developing a relationship with your employee. Because if you go to them with things that you see and that person is not violating the policy, then the possibility exists they're going to reject you, may even file a grievance against you. But so you have to do the work first of developing a relationship so you can talk about very sensitive issues. On the normal circumstances, you can't do that with a person that you casually hang out with. But as a leader, you need to truly, truly, truly be engaged with your employees. A great book that indicates that or illustrate that is written by Dr. Kevin Lehman. And the title of this is a religious book, and it's entitled The Way of the Shepherd. And he gives you seven principles of leadership. And so I teach leaders, if you follow these seven principles, you will be highly engaged with your employees so that when that time comes, and it is inevitable, it is going to happen where you need to have a crucial conversation with that employee. And I teach them about the ingredients of a crucial conversation. When you have opposing opinions, strong emotions, and stakes are high. And so when those three things are present, the employee will shy away from having that crucial conversation, or the leader may shy away. Well, I tell the leader, you need to have the courage to engage, but you have to do your front end programming first. If you don't front end program that officer, you're not going to be able to engage them in intimate, detailed conversations about their personal stuff and their personal lives.
So, Mike, I mean, this is a, it's kind of an Enneagram question, but again, I'm asking questions out of ignorance, but why is it that Derek Chauvin or other officers who, you know, we've heard, we've just had so many stories about them, right?
Right.
Why is it, what is it in the bureaucracy or the organizational system that allows for these kinds of folks to stick around, you know what I mean? Or not get help. I mean, like you were saying, they're afraid. And I'm like, well, gosh, it doesn't sound like, I don't think about policemen about being afraid. Is it a case of, you know, being loyal beyond what should be acceptable? I mean, like what's happening, do you think?
No, I think it's, well, usually when you see situations like Derek Chauvin, there are four things missing from the organization.
Okay.
Leadership engagement, psychological safety, mental and emotional wellness, and the work environment is toxic. So, in my description of a police officer at work is this: we are normal people, abnormal circumstances, behaving abnormally, and that's normal. So if you think about that, we find ourselves as normal people dealing with a ton of abnormal situations. And because we're constantly dealing with those abnormalities, we begin to behave in very abnormal ways, and that becomes the norm. So when Derek Chauvin is doing Derek Chauvin, everybody is accustomed to it. So we say nothing because we don't know what to say, because it's very difficult to articulate. So we say absolutely nothing, and we just typically wait until he fall off the wagon or he does something very egregious. And we talk about him for a little while. And the only reason we talk about him for a little while is because another cop is about to peak that same heel. See, there's so many things that are happening behind the scenes that the average person have no idea what happens in police departments. For example, a police officer is 300% more likely to suffer from alcoholism than general population. Wow. See, so every 32 to 54 hours, somewhere in the United States, there's a police officer committing suicide. There are 900,000 law enforcement officers nationally, 18,500 agencies. And you have a ton of police officers that I categorize as walking wounded. You see, so we are so accustomed to these things and we don't know what to do to address them. So what do? We create policy. We create legislation to try to control the nervous system when all we really need to do is engage those employees. The science or the research says, and I think I mentioned this already, An engaged employee with their supervisor will outperform the average by 202%. You see, so if I'm engaged with that employee, I will see those things. I could say something about those things, and I can mitigate them before they become a major issue. It's never a surprise when a cop go off the rail. It's never a surprise.
Mm. Wow. Mm. All right, more. Okay, so now another conversation just above that. Okay, and maybe this enters the world of the spiritual, you know, because it's a large question. But, you know, we're in the middle of this in terribly important conversation around race in America.
Right.
And one of the things I've wondered to myself is, how can the Enneagram inform that conversation? Like, is there anything is there wisdom to be found in the Enneagram that would make a helpful contribution to that conversation?
Absolutely. My system does that very thing as well.
All right, tell me about that.
We're still dealing with behavior, right? So, if a police department has core values and guiding principles, they're polar opposite of a racist police officer, polar opposite, right? So if we are following those core values, guiding principles, and a police officer says something that's racist or do something that's questionable, that system will pick that up and it will name it.
Mm.
And then it would also give strategies of how to address what you just observed. Mm-hmm. See, the beauty of neurobehavior science is a wonderful tool. Why? Because it's proven. And all I did was create a language around neurobehavior science that could help me decipher what I see and what I know to be true. It gives me a direction. It gives me a platform, a system, a strategy of addressing the issue that I just discovered in that office.
So, Mike, in your relationship with your wife, what do you know her type?
Yeah, she's a one, and she's also she's a therapist.
Oh, wow.
And she used the Enneagram in her sessions.
Wow.
Yes. And she's probably 3 or 4 months away from PhD in marriage and family therapy.
Oh, that's awesome. So, question, how has it affected your marriage?
Well, wow. That's a great question. So I'm going to get pretty transparent here.
Please.
Probably about 15 years of our marriage was horrible. And it wasn't until we were introduced to the Enneagram. Mm. And I'll never forget the panel I sat on for the first time. My wife was in the audience. Mm. And as Dr. Bradstreet were asking questions, she lit up like a Christmas tree.
Mm.
For the first time, she understood me.
Wow.
Yes. And it was, you're talking about a phenomenal conversation on our way home in our car.
Wow.
Yes, it was phenomenal. And it really saved our marriage, and it saved my life.
Mm.
Because here's the deal, guys. When I was at my best, I was at my worst.
What does that mean?
Well, I was a high performer. I was a high producing cop. But there was a time in my career where I was off the chain. I had like 4 crashes within a 6-month span because I was not spiritually grounded. I did not know Mike Alexander. I was being triggered by the calls and the images of dead bodies and babies and suicides. And I did not know how to interpret what was going on with me. So what happens is police officers, we will gravitate towards dysfunctional things to cope. So what, be it alcohol, be it work, I did both of those. I buried myself in work, and I became very good at my craft.
Yeah, well, but, you sixes are doers, man.
Yeah,
yeah. You're doers. Okay, so you got good at your craft.
Yeah, I got very good, and I began to drink. And my wife don't drink. But I tell you, she's such a brilliant woman in that wow. I would come home and drink, and she would just create a space for me, and just make sure I'm okay. And I'll never forget when I was really in a bad place. And my kids and her was at the dinner table. She tells me this story. And my oldest daughter said, "I hate that. I hate that." And my wife said, "No, you can't hate your dad. Your dad is sick right now. And what you need to do more than anything else is pray for him. And let's pray that God would take care of him while he takes this journey." And so my mission now, guys, is I see cops. I see what they're struggling with. Divorce rate in our profession is so high. It's off the charts. And so many cops are just spiraling out of control, and they have no idea. And then the leaders in these organizations have no idea what to do to help them. So that was my motivation for creating the tool in which I created to try to interface with these organizations to save lives. So I created a platform called Clearing the Pathway for Healing and Policing in America. Because we cannot, as a, wow, we need police. There's no way on God's green earth that we could do what we do without having police officers. But we need good, morally sound, ethical cops who are willing to do the right thing, but they don't know themselves. And so we need leaders to be informed so that they can help these cops. And I always equate this to the nervous system, you know, the autonomic nervous system. When that sympathetic nervous system is hijacked and it activates the fight, flight, or freeze response. The supervisor is supposed to become the parasympathetic nervous system so that he can help or she can help regulate that cop and bring them down. Peter Levine wrote a book called The Unspoken Voice, where he talks about people getting stuck in hyper arousal or hypo-arousal. So many cops getting stuck in either of those categories. Well, but he also talks about a resilience zone where throughout that day of 8 to 10 hours, 12 hours, whatever we work, there are constant charges and then there's a release. There's another charge and then there's a release. The supervisor is responsible for keeping that police officer in a certain zone. And I call that the resilience zone. And if the supervisor is uninformed and unaware, he's going to lose a cop. He's going to lose a very good cop. And we're constantly losing them.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to get emotional, but.
Oh, that's okay. This is typology, man. We do emotions here. It's okay. You got 2 4s listening. We're perfectly fine, man. You want to go there. We know how to go with you and be perfectly comfortable with it. So, no problems. Well, Mike, this conversation has been extraordinary.
So good.
Really extraordinary. Yeah. And I'm leaving this conversation just feeling such a tremendous amount of admiration for you and for your work, for your commitment, for your desire to help create environments in which people can bring their whole person to work, where they can learn to discover who they are, to capitalize on the great gifts they bring to the table, and also to become self-aware enough to know in the moment when those aspects of their type, those unskillful, unhelpful aspects of their person are taking over.
That's exactly right.
You know, and what a great mission, man. Mm. And it just encourages me, and it's wonderful to know in an age when, you know, there's a lot of bad press about the police, right? That to have you on, I think, is a great gift to all of our listeners, and I hope a great encouragement to them. Mm-hmm. That there are, you know, men and women like you out there who are doing the good work, you know, and using the Enneagram, man, to do it.
Yes, yes. Like I said, it saved my life. It saved my marriage. It just saved me as a human being, and I am grateful.
Yeah. Well, we're grateful for you and for all that you do, and we're going to have you back on, man.
Yeah.
For sure.
Tell us how people can learn more about what you're doing and social handles and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I am not technology savvy, so I have Adrian Sanders Kate that really helped me with all of that stuff. So she's created all of those social handles of Instagram and Twitter, and I have a LinkedIn page, so you can definitely find me on LinkedIn.
Yes.
You can find me. I have a website called Lion LION Strategy Group. And you can find all of our offerings there. Mm-hmm. Pretty much everything that we do, you will find contained within the Lion Strategy Group website.
Right.
I partnered with another chief who happens to be a Enneagram 5.
Mm-hmm.
We also have an attorney on our team. So the three of us are out to do revolutionary things for this country we call the US of A.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So that's lionstrategy.group.
Yeah.
You can learn more about what Mike's doing there.
And then on Instagram, it's lion_strategy group. So everybody go follow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go check that out. Mike, peace and grace to you. And we hope to have you back on again. Typology Tribe, remember these words. May you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. May you have rest. Until next time.
Thank you, guys.